This is Story and Rain Talks, the Story and Rain podcast. I'm Tamara, founder and editor-in-chief. After over 20 years in the fashion and magazine industries, I launched storyandrain.com, a digital fashion, beauty, and lifestyle publication where we're bridging the gap between reading a magazine and shopping its pages. On this podcast, you'll discover the emerging trends and tastemakers that matter right now. As a catalyst for creativity and through candid conversations with our community of cultural arbiters, we're your resource for discovering today's most interesting people, projects, and products. And we'll explore the origins for game-changing ideas and careers. With our high-low approach to style and the belief that there's magic in the mix, we're going to inspire you to live your most stylish life. The recently established Makeup Museum, located in downtown New York City, explores the history of beauty and its ongoing impact on society. It's a cool and dynamic space that celebrates beauty culture. One particular exhibit dates back decades, showcasing Erno Laszlo's personalized skincare prescriptions for both Marilyn Monroe and Jackie Kennedy. But on this podcast, we talk Kevin O'Quinn, the iconic makeup artist and beauty pioneer whose work made an impact on my own life and on Story and Rain. Working with his family, the Makeup Museum has digitized over 1,600 pages from his 7 journals. The legendary talent and visionary kept years of calendar planner books that he added visual elements to, magazine cutouts, Polaroid photos, and stickers decorated each dated section. Today, those pages provide a fascinating inside look into not only all of his famous projects and top jobs, but his creative life and mind. I sat down with two of the museum's founders, Doreen Block and Rachel Goodwin, the celebrity makeup artists whose work you recognize on such stars as Emma Stone and Julia Roberts. We were joined by Kevin O'Quinn's niece, Samantha Adkisson, who shares intimate details about her uncle, his vision, and of course, his journals. We discussed the museum's founding, working with artifacts, Kevin O'Quinn's place in pop culture, and much more. I hope you'll enjoy listening to this incredibly exclusive talk with the Makeup Museum and on one of the ultimate pioneer creatives of our time, Kevin O'Quinn. Hi, everyone. I'm here with the two co-founders from New York City's new Makeup Museum, celebrity makeup artist Rachel Goodwin and Doreen Block. We also have the pleasure to be here with Samantha Adkisson, who's the niece of the late great makeup artist legend and pioneer Kevin O'Quinn. So first, I would love to ask Doreen this question. Tell the story about how the Makeup Museum came to be.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having us today. And it's such a joy to be on with Rachel and Samantha. The Makeup Museum has been a concept of myself and now a group of people for about 2 years now. So it was a little over 2 years ago that the idea was born in my mind and started reaching out to people in the industry. I've been in the cosmetics industry for almost 10 years. And the feedback was unanimous. This had to exist. And how did it not exist before? You know, clearly there's been exhibitions that have had cosmetics, you know, involved in some way, shape, or form, but never an institution that is focused on preservation, education, and celebration of all things makeup. And so I was so overjoyed to be connected with Rachel. This was over a year ago, and she has been one of the key people to help this get off the ground into the point that it is today. And then, you know, along the way, it's been such a joy to connect with Samantha and so many others across the cosmetics industry and beyond around a lot of the neat initiatives that we're working on.
That was one of my next questions for you, is what was the connection between the two founders and then to you, Samantha? Was there, had you all known each other before, or did you connect just via this project?
Oh, go ahead, Samantha. I was going to say Rachel might be a good one to take this. It's been a lot
That's
of
what I was going to say. I think Rachel put us all in touch.
Okay, so Rachel, we just found out that Rachel is the connector. So is that right? You connected Samantha to
Well, it's interesting. It was kind of all, you know, serendipitous for sure. There's a lot of serendipity involved in all the areas. And I think for me, I, as a makeup artist, have been fascinated by the history of makeup and the inner workings of the beauty industry. You know, as a person who's been participating in it, you know, for the last 25 years. And as a working makeup artist, I have, you know, kind of come up through different, you know, had different, you know, chapters of my career and been interested in different things. And I think makeup history is something that's always followed me from the beginning. And I was introduced to Doreen through a friend who knew my passion for the, you know, for the whole subject and said, oh, you need to meet Doreen because she's actually thinking about following through with this. And I thought, oh, if there's someone that's going to do it, I have to know who they are. We have to meet. And so I was totally, again, serendipitously up in Silicon Valley for a job. And that's, you know, where Doreen lives. And I just said, let's sit down and talk about makeup. And we met and it was just immediately, we knew we were speaking the same language. And then throughout, you know, then we started our journey, really kind of honing the vision for what we wanted. The first, iteration obviously being Pink Jungle. But we also both share the dream of really creating a space that is going to ultimately carry all the different chapters of beauty history, all of the different areas from the beginning until now. And Kevin, for me, was a personal hero.
That was one of my upcoming questions for you, was what does he mean to you?
So. Yeah. Personal hero. personal hero as a human being and also as a facilitator of really, I think, opening my, being an expander for me, for being able to understand that this kind of career could exist. I think for me, as a young artist, I had lots of dreams of, you know, Pat McGrath was another huge one for me. Yeah. But obviously Kevin, the way he transformed people and the way he saw the beauty in all women, the way he made women feel, that really I really connected to. And so another mutual friend introduced Samantha. So all of these like layers came together. It was very, my good friend Troy, a dear friend of mine, worked with Kevin and facilitated through,
Through Troy.
Troy is a connector. If anyone's a connector here, I think it's Troy.
We love connector people. Rachel, what does your role entail as co-founder? Do you have a specific area that you handle?
I feel like my role has been a bit more carved out recently. I think we're kind of, you know, in the beginning, it was just like, we're all doing all the things. I think everyone's just sort of like, participating, showing up and doing whatever makes sense at the time, whatever we're facing, you know, because opening during a pandemic was definitely, you know, something that this was a huge challenge. But my role, if I was to, you know, distill it down, is really about the artistry element of the beauty, you know, of the makeup museum, and how, for me, if I could have one dream come true from this, is that I would love for people to understand and to see makeup artistry as an actual true art form, and to elevate it to fine art status.
It's total artistry. And Doreen, what about you? What do you specifically do for the museum?
Yeah, so my focus is logistics. You know, I'm the logistics queen, just, you know, making sure all the gears fit together and that everything works. And, you know, I think a great example of this, you know, going back to Kevin's incredible journals, where, you know, first the, you know, just the logistics of in, you know, pre-COVID, what we would have done, what any museum would do.
Right.
You know, work with Kevin's family, with Samantha, with Carla, and, you know, have the journals come on site where our team would be able to handle them, you know, with all of the protocol, with gloves, with masks, all of those things that anyone in anthropology research and preservation would do. But because of the pandemic, the museum wasn't open yet. How are we going to, you know, do this digitization project remotely? And so that's where my mind comes in around, you know, how do you hire a photographer remotely and get all these pieces together? And ultimately, you know, this digitization effort has netted 1,600 photographs.
Yes.
We're still going through them. Samantha, I don't know if you're still going through them as well.
I actually want to ask you both about that very, very specifically. But here's my question to you, Doreen. How does one go about creating a museum? How do you create a museum? I mean, think about this. How do you create a museum? It's epic. It's really, it's a big deal. So How do you do that? I mean, can you describe a little bit about the process? What happens first? What happens second? What happens?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think it's surrendering to the idea that you will never be able to do it alone. You have to have a team. And so that was the first step for me was, you know, speaking with Caitlin Collins, who, by the way, is our third co-founder, yes. Who has more of the brand expertise. She's the former editor of makeup.com and worked at L'Oreal for many years. And, you know, then she brought in different people that she knew and, you know, reaching out to folks in our network who have that museum experience. So we have advisors who are part of the U.S. Holocaust Museum from, you know, Smithsonian, MIT. And with this incredible group of, you know, the co-founding team, supporters like makeup historian Gabriela Hernandez, Louise Young in the UK, Madeline Marsh, with all of that incredible positive energy, then being able to put the parts together, you know, I think the second, you know, you were saying, what's the second step? So I think, you know, besides having a team, also, of course, having a set of collections. That's really the core of what a museum is.
Having something to show, right.
Exactly. So we've started collecting, you know, over the last 2 years, we have our core collection. And then we also have items that are on loan from corporate archives and donations that have come in from all around the world, which has been amazing. And again, it's just incredible to be that hub and that safe space for beauty lovers and aficionados to engage in this way and kind of nerd out about these things that we're so passionate about.
Yeah.
What Lauren is not going to say to you right now is that she is a absolute force of nature, and that she had the gall to do it. Like, this is really
where
I think, like, a lot of people talk, okay? Like, a lot of people say things and a lot of people have ideas, but for actually taking the action needed and showing up every day full force is where I bow to Doreen's energy and her absolute razor sharp focus and her dedication to seeing this through, even during very difficult, incredibly difficult circumstances when we finally were opening May 1st and then didn't get to, and all of the pivoting and everything. But I just want to say, yes, all of those things are true, she just said, but then the other part, which is just having the audacity and the will and the energy and drive. It's pretty amazing.
You can dream up ideas all you want, but until you put those into action, they're never going to happen.
She's a woman of action.
You can't see me, but I'm blushing.
She's blushing. Let's switch gears for a minute. I want to ask both founders this, but first Doreen, can you describe a moment of profound creativity you've experienced tied to the museum? What would that be?
I mean, there's been so many incredible experiences, but I have to say that one of the most transformative moments was opening this digital archive of Kevin's journals.
I mean,
just, you know, I'm getting the goosebumps again right now.
I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it.
So much kudos, you know, to Samantha and the entire family of Kevin O'Quan for giving us this honor. It's it really feels so profound to do something that is bigger than yourself, that is about helping to continue a legacy and share a legacy. And so, you know, just getting to see these photographs, these Polaroid images, these doodles and sketches and stickers, and just reflecting back on a life that was lived so fully and so artistically, I think is one of the most creative moments that I've had the pleasure to experience in my
entire
career.
Fully and artistically, that's really well said. What about you, Rachel? Can you describe, like, what is your moment of profound creativity tied to the museum?
Gosh. I definitely feel like having my, just being able, I think the journals really were what kept me sane during the pandemic, because I think those, and we had been planning Pink Jungle and working on this thing, and obviously I'm super proud of it. You know, I think the journals and get the first time I opened them and I sat with them and I I was in a, you know, we were really in the midst of it and we were in the thick of realizing we weren't going to open and knowing that this wasn't going to happen after almost a year of working on it. And when the journals came in, it was like, I cried. I totally cried because it was just witnessing why I love makeup artistry, why I love what I do again. Yeah. And seeing the incredible dedication to his craft and the joy. And it made me remember the joy of doing this for a job, for a living. And I
just maybe reinvigorated the joy.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Absolutely. And I felt like it was so, I felt like that little bit of beauty in that moment was just, it really did feel like a creative, the clouds parting in that moment for sure. So
now working on the museum, Rachel, was a big kind of pivot for you. How often are you still working with clients and on shoots as a makeup artist? And who do you typically work with?
Yeah, I mean, I am just now sort of stepping back into work again after, you know, I went back for the Democratic Convention with Julia Louis-Dreyfus as my first job back. And then I've been working recently with, you know, Rachel Brosnahan from Mrs. Maisel.
Oh, we're gonna do something with her.
I'm obsessed with her.
Okay,
she's
good.
Incredible. Just worked with her recently. And then I am just sort of doing little things here and there that feel right to me with clients. And I've worked with Emma Stone for, 14 years. So I feel like I have my main clients that I sort of am just going back in with and doing things that feel right. But I'm not traveling. I'm not moving around. I haven't even been to the museum. I mean, it's absolutely devastating.
Yes. We all have to go. I'm dying to go.
I know. So yeah, not the
same. I'm like, I can't wait for that outing.
Me too.
Rachel, I'd love to hear a description. Describe the makeup museum in your own words. How would you just quickly describe it?
I would say it's joyful and a little respite from, from the real world. It's like a little bit of, it's education, but it's in a way that you can really understand our connection to beauty. I think our relationships with beauty personally as women, it's a little way to get, it's like, I always say it's like a place to go raise your beauty IQ. It's a little, it's fun, but it also, you leave enriched and you leave more connected to yourself.
I bet. Doreen, can you do the same thing? How would you describe the museum in your own words?
Oh, I loved Rachel's description just now. I would totally agree. I mean, we really seek to strike that balance between educational but accessible education, where it is fun, it's engaging. And also, I would just add inclusive. That's so core to what we're doing and building. And it's part of the foundation that we do also want to include men and include the entire spectrum of color and culture and tradition. And that's actually something that we'll be announcing soon, in terms of another initiative that we have around really looking back through history and providing a more inclusive lens around narratives that simply haven't been told in the mainstream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Rachel, how do you find items and subjects worthy of display at the museum? What's that process like?
Well, I think for Pink Jungle, a lot of the procurement was Doreen's doing as far as like the items.
Right.
But I do think like going forward, I will be taking on a more curatorial role. And I think especially in light of like some of the newer things we're going to be, I will be much more hands-on in that area. And I'm very excited about that because I love, obviously beauty is my life and I want to create immersive, incredible experiences for people where they are, they are surrounded by why does beauty matter to us so much? And why is it important in our daily lives? It's often seen as a completely surface subject and it has nothing to do with anything important. But what we're trying to do is say it does though.
Beauty stands the test of time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and what is it?
There's like iterations of beauty in every, decade, every century.
And I think we have some incredible artifacts around this right now in the Pink Jungle exhibition that speaks to exactly what Rachel's saying. And, for example, we had to consult with presidential historians around the skincare prescription for Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy that's on display because she talks about Mr. Kennedy using a bunch of her products to make himself feel better and more confident. And so, you know, when people say beauty is frivolous, no, it has the power to change history.
That's really good. That's a good story. How long will exhibits last for? There's some permanent, there's some rotating and some permanent. Do you guys have a schedule for that or a framework for that or not?
I did.
I know we did, exactly. I mean, so much has changed, but you know, the dream of Makeup Museum, and as with, you know, a lot of museums, it's a long journey to establish an institution and, you know, a private collection that spans all of makeup history. Today, our collection spans 5,000 years and we're continuing to collect aggressively. And, you know, the dream is to eventually have a permanent space that will have that private collection spanning all of history in addition to temporary rotating exhibitions. Currently, Pink Jungle is slated to be on display for 6 months, so through February. Then we'll shift to a new topic.
Yes, that's great. Dream exhibit, either one of you, Doreen and Rachel, is there a dream exhibit? Is there something you maybe dreamt up in your head that you would love to see at the museum?
We have so many.
Well, we have so many, but my first one really is in regard to, you know, it is really about Kevin. Kevin, a retrospective, a full honoring him and his legacy and his contribution to our industry. Because for me, I feel like for a lot of people, he is the symbol of what it means to be a modern makeup artist. There is the, you know, incredible stories that we will be telling throughout, you know, and we ultimately, Doreen and I both, and Caitlin, our goal is to have an institution that encompasses all the eras and all the, you know, like she was saying, from the beginning until now. And so having like a full scale, a space that can encompass all that. But ultimately we are going to have exhibitions that will focus, whether it be on a singular topic or a singular artist. And I think the first, you know, one being Kevin would be a dream come true, because I do think people, first of all, I think it's a story that never gets old because it's just totally inspirational. And the way that he documented, like we see in his journals, I'm sure Samantha, you can attest to this. It's like the way that he documented his story so incredibly this is prior to the digital age. And I think it has such an impact on people to see the way he documented it prior to social media, prior to us having internet. This is where it gets really fascinating. I think that we can, you know, to be able to showcase, like when I saw his journals the first time, I wept from a place of a industry that doesn't exist anymore.
Yes, I know it.
You know,
I've been around for a while too.
Yeah. So it really was just so beautiful to see Polaroids by pen.
I mean, I have the Polaroids and the taping it into your planner. It's like, I did the same sorts of things, you know?
Yeah. This is like these, you know, we used to have to look through loops and we used to have to take our Polaroids. And these are things that I think a lot of artists today don't recognize and don't understand. So to be able to showcase that and that he did it, I almost felt like he was, I don't know how he would have known, but it's like, it's a gift. It's such a gift. And I would love to see that given to the next generation of makeup artists.
Yeah. Obviously going to talk all about Kevin, but one last question before we get into it. Kevin's amazing journals. You opened up, unfortunately, but fortunately during the pandemic, we talked about that.
Yeah.
Do you have any plans for how the museum is going to evolve? Are there loose plans or any additions or changes you're thinking of making yet? Or
Doreen? Yeah, everything is still so day at a time.
It you really know, is day at a time. Yeah.
It's so precarious.
Hard to make plans.
Yeah, but I mean, it felt, and that was the decision that we were grappling with when, you know, we literally saw from a tweet, it was, you know, Governor Cuomo sent out a tweet saying cultural institutions could open. And we went to each and every one of our stakeholders, you know, our advisors, of course, us as a core team, visitors, staff, and said, you know, we asked people like, should we open, should we not? And there were a few people, you know, in terms of the on-site staff, like, you know, maybe 10% who didn't feel comfortable yet working on-site. But the vast majority of staff and visitors, absolutely, and advisors said, you know, the world needs this right now, especially the beauty world. There are so many people out of work. If we have the opportunity to employ people who are as passionate about makeup and makeup history as we are and give visitors a respite from the mayhem of the year, it's really net positive. So that said, because, you know, there's still second, third, fourth waves most likely coming, we're, you know, really taking everything day at a time, making sure that our protocols are focused on safety, visitor safety, staff safety, first and foremost, and that's the most important thing.
Yeah. Samantha, so family was a big part of Kevin O'Quinn's story. And in Making Faces, I'm not sure about the other two books, but I know that Making Faces is dedicated to you, and your mother, your aunt, and your grandmother appear in the book. What I love about his book from 1997, it was, is that it's dedicated to 58 top makeup artists, from Francois Nars to Pat McGrath and our friend Bridget Reese Anderson, you know, 58 of them. What do you think that says about him?
He just appreciated the creativity involved in the whole industry. It wasn't just about the competition between who's getting the work. For him, it really was a craft and it really was the art of it. And I think maybe I didn't realize that for a long time, because it did sort of seem like he was 15 when I was 15 when he passed away.
Yeah.
And it did sort of seem superfluous and kind of frivolous to wear makeup at that time. And so just in the time since he's passed and the projects that have been done on his life have really made me dig deeper and really see the absolute beauty in what he was creating. And that it was about a lot more than just makeup for him. It was about what makeup said to people, what makeup could make people feel. Yep. And he knew that everybody else who was doing it in the industry was sharing that same thing with people.
Yeah, that's a great point. He was a pioneer in so many ways and seemed to approach everything as an artist. He was very forward thinking. In his book, he includes makeup for men, for teens. He even had a section on plastic surgery with regard to how to change the face. And in one of his journals, he'd cut out an article on cosmetics and animal testing. This was in 1988 that he was involved with animal activists. And is there anything that you experienced with your uncle, Samantha, that signal to you that this was someone with extraordinary vision, even at 13, 14, 15, right before he passed?
I think it's something that I had always seen in him. Like, he brought a magic to everything. When he would come to visit, it wasn't just, oh, we're going to run to the park, we're going to do that. We would create plays. Sometimes, I mean, he documented everything, which if you were in his life could be tedious, as much as it's wonderful to have now, when you're just trying to hang out and it's like, no, just five more pictures, just five more. But it is wonderful to have, especially since he's been gone. It's just really nice to have those things.
Yeah.
But I think he just brought magic to everything that he did. So yeah. Those special moments that I remember are making plays at my grandmother's, making music videos, getting to wear costumes.
Being totally creative, untethered creativity.
Mm-hmm.
That's so special to experience something like that from a family member as a child. And when your family shares stories about them, do they share stories also about him sort of being ahead of his time? What are the things that your family shares when they think about him or talk about him?
I think especially growing up as a gay man in Louisiana at the time that he did, they talk a lot about how his interests were very different than the other people that they were around.
Right.
It was the South, so the boys were playing baseball and they were outside and he was like saving birds and listening to Barbara Streisand. So there's a lot of, he stood out a lot when he was younger. And so that's something that they talk about pretty frequently. But I think the thing that everybody, at least in our family, but everybody that I've talked to about him really talks about is his heart and how he was always there for people. He was their confidant, the person that they trusted the most and could talk about those difficult things with.
The Makeup Museum has acquired 7 of Kevin O'Quinn's journals. And there are, Doreen, as you said, there's a total of 1,600 magnificent individual pages or images, I would say. Doreen, can you describe the journals and their detail?
Sure. And by the way, we have not acquired them. I mean, it's still the property of the family, but, you know, the family has been.
Oh, in that respect, but you have the, you have the digital prints.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And You know, the journals, they're the first one is from 1983. And the most current is 1994. And so, you know, it's just incredible. It spans what's just remarkable about seeing these journals is, you know, the first time that Kevin O'Quinn went to Vogue, for example, is documented in the 1983 journal. And so you can see what he was doing that day. You know, some of the things were slightly mundane. He had like a futon delivery that week. So
I mean, it was a planner that just to give people a clear picture. Most of the journals, I might be wrong on this, all seven are in planner format, in like a daily diary format. So that's why you would have like Polaroid images mixed with, you know, to-do lists for the day, right?
Exactly. And so, you know, interspersed, you just see the trajectory of Kevin's life and career where it's just so profound for the Makeup Museum to be able to document these types of things where, you know, the first time, for example, that he worked with Cindy Crawford or, with Paulina Porizkova, you know, these iconic collaborations are documented. And, you know, just to be able to see that trajectory, I think one of the other really fascinating things, for example, Samantha was sharing that Kevin, you know, loved Barbara Streisand, for example. And so, how incredible to see that Kevin went to see the movie Yentl twice with friends. And then a few years later, he's at Barbara Streisand's birthday party. You know,
so these crazy times.
But, you know, I think for, you know, Rachel brought in for us, you know, the artistry perspective. And then, you know, just from, I would say, someone who is less sophisticated with the details and nuance of the artistry itself, just seeing someone who took the full advantage of life, it is inspiring for everyone, whether they're a makeup artist or not.
Right. It just sounded like it's such a documentation of how much he was immersed in his work and in love with his work. Are there any big marked differences between the journals in 1983 and the later journals? Do you see any overarching sort of themes or things that have changed over the course of those journals?
Yeah, I mean, a decade in makeup history is a long time. I mean, you can definitely see the evolution of the makeup looks and the artistry itself, the techniques. I think there's still so much more for us to unpack here.
And we were saying that you haven't actually acquired the actual journals. That's TBD for a later date. You have digital. Where can people go to see the digital scans of the journals?
We are releasing images slowly, but, you know, consistently and slowly because there's a lot of private information in these journals. So we need to redact, you know, phone numbers and mailing addresses, that type of thing. As well as, you know, we're continuing to talk often with Samantha and with Troy and with Eric Sakas and Jed and some of these other key people in Kevin's life at different moments to understand a lot of the influences or references that are in some of these throughout, you know, a lot of the books. For example, you know, I remember we reached out to Eric earlier this year to ask, you know, hey, Kevin has a lot in here about animal, you know, cruelty-free and activism for animals. Was he a vegetarian? You know, and so just even understanding those kinds of references for the museum is so important. Sorry, your question again. I went on a tangent.
It was just sort of where, you know,
where can people find them? Right.
Yes. Find them if they want to go see them.
Yeah. So we're slowly but consistently releasing these images to the Makeup Museum's mobile app, which is available on iOS and Android. It is a paid app, but, you know, full of incredible resources, and it goes to support the museum's mission.
Perfect. Samantha, has this been emotional for you working on this? I mean,
it has been emotional. I think a lot of the emotions were sort of processed through when we worked with Tiffany and Jace Bartok on the film. That was probably the beginning of it, really, and a very important healing process for my whole family as well. When you lose someone that's so pivotal to your family, mm-hmm. you almost can't process it. Like, you definitely need distance and time from it to be able to process it. And yeah. And having it sort of being able to watch it on the outside, even if we are in it, looking at yourself, looking at your family, talking about it, it's a very different experience. And it allowed for a lot of healing, a lot of processing that needed to happen. But definitely the journals, there's something so Kevin about them that...
Explain that. What does that mean?
For me, it's probably a feeling. Yeah. Like, it's the feeling that I got when I was with him, which is
what
just
was the feeling the that you got when you were
important person in the world.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you get this of a book about other people. Like, you know, it's pictures of mostly other people, but you just see how much he values the people that are in his life. And when you were with him, you felt like you were $1 million. You were the most famous person on the planet. You were fascinating. He thought people were so interesting. And he wanted to know how you thought, and he wanted to, how did you get to that idea? What did you think of? What feelings were you feeling? There was a lot of naming feelings, which when you're like 5 and 6 is not great, but but helps in the long run. So, you know, he had a lot of foresight there, but he definitely, and I think just looking at those reminds me of the value that he placed in the people around him.
And it seems to me that he put a lot of time and care and attention into things, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what can make you a really great artist, right? Is that your attention to detail and being passionate. Mm-hmm. Now how exactly did you go about working together? You explained a little bit about it in the beginning, but who had the journals, Samantha? Were they...
My mother in Louisiana had some of them. I believe Eric might have had a couple. And Troy is a family friend and reached out and connected everybody together. And Doreen sent somebody down to archive everything.
Wow. What is the archive process like, Doreen? What did you have to do for that?
It took a couple weeks. I think it was 3 weeks or so, you know, of the photographer archivist driving, and he's based in Baton Rouge. So I believe it was just, you know, car drive over, obviously being safe amidst the pandemic, again, in terms of protocol. And what was also really fun in this process is that one of the journals was actually discovered as part of this. So I think there were initially 6 that we were going to document. And then Carla, Samantha's mom, found another one. So
where did she find it?
Samantha. I don't know.
Has boxes.
Like in a random box. Just that. See, that's serendipitous. This 7th journal appears. That's
I feel like everything with this process with Kevin has been.
There's some people that just have magic. I mean, you said it in the beginning. Magic attached to them, right?
And I also, from an outsider's perspective, you know, I also want to add onto what Samantha was saying that it is so clear through these journals that he loved and adored and admired every person in his family too. I mean, there's so many adorable, sweet pictures all throughout of Samantha and of his parents. And so, you know, not just the celebrity photos, but also just this love and adoration for his family really shines through.
Well, and that's what I was sort of saying too earlier, is that that's what kind of interesting. I mean, I bought these books years and years ago. They've been on my shelves for years, but when looking back on them, you see this sort of combination of him talking so much about his background and his family, like coupled with how to do a face and here's Gwyneth Paltrow in her eyebrow or whatever. It just, it seemed like those two worlds lived very closely together for him. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's where I think to what Rachel was saying around how he is sort of the original, the pioneer of so many of the things that we see today around social media culture and transparency and authenticity. He lived that. He was that before it was cool.
Yeah. Samantha, do you have any memories of him writing in his or showing you his journals? If so, what are they?
He would always share the pictures.
He would always flip the picture.
He would just share. I have a story that has like haunted me my whole life, which is he called me to wait. He woke me up. I was like in middle school. He called and woke me up in Louisiana and had Meryl Streep on the phone. And I told him I couldn't speak to them because it was a school night. I just said, I can't. This is irresponsible. It's 10:30. I have to go. Like, it's school tomorrow. And it's like haunted me forever.
You said that on the phone call?
No, I told my mom. She came in and said, Kevin's on the phone.
And you're
I can't. It's a school night. And she said, well, he said he has Meryl Streep. And I said, I can't. It's a school night. I have to go to bed. I need to wake up tomorrow.
Look at you, goody two shoes, right?
Lifelong regret.
What was he calling to chit chat with you about with Meryl Streep on the line?
It was important for him to share his life with people. And yes. I think the journals capture the same thing that those phone calls capture, which is pinch me moments. Mm-hmm. That he's like, this isn't real unless right. I can connect this to someone else. Because it doesn't make sense how I could be right here next to Meryl Streep or Barbara Streisand or Audrey Hepburn. So it would be pinch me moments. Like if I call and talk to my niece or my mom or my sister, it's real.
Wow.
Someone else knows it.
Wow. That's so interesting.
I think that's what touched me most about the journals, honestly, is what you just touched on, was that nothing was lost on him. And that's what those journals really showcase best, is that he was literally trying to reflect back to himself, like, this is really happening. Like
I
manifested this, but like, I can't even believe I was able to do it. Yeah. Like, and so your excitement for him is palpable because he's like, he's reflecting back to you. Like, can you believe this? This is just, you know, and it just pours out of the journals and every page.
That kind of joy is special.
Yeah.
Samantha, had you read them all through during this process? Was there ever a time where you sat and like went through all seven of them?
No. I've gone through the digitized versions and taken some time. First I went through and just looked at all my cousins and self and siblings growing up. So I went and looked through that first because that sort of, it's very overwhelming to think of looking through it all. Because of the emotions that it does bring up and the memories and his handwriting and the little notes and I don't know everything about him and I would see a note and want to ask and he's not here to. And so that is a challenge. So it really, like, you have to be in the right mindset to look at it for myself. And sometimes I can look at it and just observe how beautiful it is and everything there, but
it's a good point that you're making that, you know, looking through journals like that would provoke so many questions that you just, you know, the reality is that you'll never get the answers to them. So mm-hmm. I understand that. Any surprise or notable findings across these journals that anyone, did you stumble upon, and anyone stumble upon anything that was sort of like a wow moment or a notable moment?
So we're continuing to take really detailed notes, you know, day by day of the journals. And it is, you know, to Samantha's point, it's the very clinical part of the process that the Makeup Museum has to do. That's our role and responsibility here. And what that enables is to see those connections and be able to quantify, you know, how many times did he work with Sidney Crawford, for example, or with Janet Jackson, you know, all of these incredible people that he had such a close working relationship with. But I think what really stands out to me, and I think people will see different things in this, it's really multi-layered, but just that consistent commitment to activism is very profound for me personally. To see these notes among all of these career highlights that instead of just, you know, hanging out at home, he would go to the Gay and Lesbian Rights March in DC, for example, you know, early on in the journals. Or, you know, he would take that time to protest and to advocate. And that, again, just shows the type of incredible person that he was, and just a way for people, even if they're not makeup artists, to connect with this content. It's really a story of an incredible human being.
Yeah.
And that's another thing I think just as an artist in our industry that demands so much of you in order to succeed at the level that Kevin succeeded. Very few, and especially at the time in which he did, was reaching his pinnacle and he sustained that for many, many years. You know, there were maybe, it's amazing that he had 58, but like there were really at the top where he was, very few artists. And I will say that I don't know 100% that they all were able to make their families a priority the way that he did. I think if he made that choice from the beginning that love and family were going to be at the core of what he did, and that all this amazing of other stuff, but like you always see in his journals, like when he went home, mm-hmm. You know, who he spent his birthday with every year.
Yeah.
And, you know, when his parents came to see him make a speech when he received an award, like those were the things that like, I feel like really a lot of, I've seen a lot of casualties of the beauty industry. Of people who have given up any prospect of having a life outside of it because the demands are such. And I really admired that he, as much as he did, as much as he accomplished and the heights that he reached, he never lost sight of what was really, really important.
Yes.
With his family. And I think that makes him remarkable. In our industry.
It is remarkable. And he, you know, he was working with so many female beauty icons, and he was notably close with so many of them. Yeah. Many of them appear in these journals. Yeah. Samantha, how do you think Kevin maintained such a closeness with the celebrities and stars he worked on? Or anyone? Samantha, start with you.
I think so much of it is just like being a genuine person. Like he wouldn't feel uncomfortable about them and would very quickly go into a deep personal story. Like he was always doing his own work. So when he, and was very open to sharing that with people, and that really allowed other people to open up as well. So it really, he just lived in that sort of presence of being vulnerable and being okay with being vulnerable. And that allows for a lot of connection in an industry that maybe otherwise doesn't allow for that a lot.
Mm-hmm. And it's an intimate space that you're in as a makeup artist. And he had these hands, as you see in the documentary, these remarkably large hands. And he would, you know, the way that women, I feel like there was just a safety that he created for, you know, as a makeup artist in that intimate space. I know how intimate it is.
Yes.
And, you know, it's, you know, you can feel very vulnerable, like, but he, like you said, he made his own vulnerability. So he created that, like, and he had a way of making anyone in front of him feel special. Mm-hmm. I had this here because I wanted to show you. So you can't see it obviously because this is a podcast. So I had waited in line in San Francisco where I'm from. I waited in line to meet Kevin at Rizzoli. This book, I wore this makeup that he has right here on Chandra Norris.
So Rachel is showing us her copy of Making Faces, which you just said you waited in line for. I see some autograph here.
And I waited in line to meet Kevin. I wore the makeup that's on the first page of the
book. What's the makeup that's on the first page?
It was like yellow eyeshadow and a red lip. It was quite a bold look.
Yes. It's
real look, and I was into the bold look at that point. And he was just the most genuinely loving and like he wrote, "For amazing Rachel, your beautiful heart shines through your radiant smile. Love, Kevin." And at that time, as a young artist who was wearing, you know, my makeup, like based on his inspired by him, wanting nothing more than to be a part of this industry that seemed so glamorous and exciting to me. And to know that there was a man at the top of that field, the one at the top was kind and caring and inclusive was everything, because every other representation I had seen up until that point from a fashion perspective was alienating, rude, critical, it was like, you can't sit with us. Kevin was the opposite. Kevin was, sit down with me, let's talk, recognizing everyone's talent, recognizing everyone's unique beauty. And that is why his legacy is so important. I think outside of the contribution of his incredible work as a painter, true painter,
yep,
and transformational artist, he is, the legacy is of his ability to bring artists up behind him to create more space for artistry, like, and makeup artists. And so he has a bigger impact on the actual industry than a lot of other makeup artists. As much as I revere them for their contributions in their work, I revere him for something different. It's his work and his ability to lift others.
Samantha, what would Kevin be doing or achieving today if he was still alive? What do you think?
Whew, that's a big one. I think his social media would be incredible. Oh, that's something that everybody talks about. Like he just
his Instagram just, stories would be on fire.
His so good. It would be share, everything. but I think he had a part of him, and you can see that in sort of his lore columns. He really wanted to help make people better, not only through his advocacy, that was important to him, but he also, it was very important to him that people had self-esteem, that people saw the specialness in themselves, that people realized that even though they look different, even though they may have a different skin color, that they were still beautiful. His makeup line started with all these different colors of the Sensual Skin Enhancer, way before the time where people were launching entire color lines.
That's right.
And so it was, besides the technique, the artistry, the formulas, just that I think there would have been something there, whether it was self-help, motivational, Brené Brown, like he's very much along those lines. I could see him being like, he and Brené Brown having a show or like a podcast.
The makeup version of Brené Brown. 100%. Motivational speaker. I love that. That's 100%. Great.
I concur.
You could, Rachel concurs. Okay, ladies, as we wrap, can you please share the location and the hours for the museum? It's an absolute must-see for everybody, but especially for beauty and fashion lovers and industry insiders. It's just absolutely fascinating. Do you want to share the location and the hours?
Absolutely. It's 94 Ganzevoort Street in the Meatpacking District in New York City. And we're open every day, but take a look at our website, makeupmuseum.com, to reserve tickets because you do need advance tickets.
Great. Thank you so much, everyone, for being on the podcast. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having us.
And Samantha, it's so good to meet you and speak to you again. Rachel, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks, Samantha. Thanks, Doreen. Oh, thank you so much for having me.
All right, guys. I hope I talk to you soon. We'll figure out a way to talk again soon or something again soon.
Come visit us soon. Stay well, everyone.
Thanks for sharing your evening with me. I know it's late now, so.
Bye.
Bye, guys. Bye.